showed in packs. They leveraged powerful neurobiology to build tighter communities, leveraged those communities to drive innovation, then open-sourced innovation to much larger communities and collectively rode the reverberations into the history books. The lone wolf maverick is a myth. When it comes to becoming Superman, we really are in this together. 9. The flow of imagination. The evolution of the double ski base. They pulled the RV up to the side of the bridge and the primal crew got to work. Miles Dasher, then 23 years old, climbed on top of the vehicle, grabbed a 2x12, and strapped it down. Half of the plank was still on the roof. The other half became a crude diving board, jutting into the darkness and over the river, a long 120 feet below. Someone else set up the bungees. A couple of folks grabbed walkie-talkies and went to spot for cops, and the newbie, this guy named Shane McConkie, stood to the side and watched. Welcome to the early 1990s, McConkie's very first night in Squaw Valley. At the time, bungee jumping was a nascent sport, underground and illegal. But McConkie had friends in the primal crew, a bunch of guys like Dasher, ski bums who worked for Primal Instinct, then one of the few bungee operations in the world willing to take paying clients on clandestine bridge jumps. This was McConkie's Welcome to Tahoe party. The Primal crew lived in the Primal House, an infamous squaw crash pad. There was a trampoline in the living room. There were always parties. The online travel magazine Matador Network once asked the question, "Ever wonder where Red Bull athletes come from?" Their answer? Back in the mid-1990s, there was a house in Squaw Valley, California. They called it the Primal House. But all of this was still to come. First, there was the small matter of that nighttime stealth mission off the bridge at Angel's Camp. Dasher went first. He took a few confident steps toward the end of the diving board, bounced once, and, because he wanted the new guy to understand, threw his best trick. "I didn't know Shane McConkie," says Dasher. "I had no idea he was a pro skier. With his long hair, I just thought he was another hippie from Colorado. So, you know, I had to let him know who he was dealing with. I threw a wild turkey." There is nothing easy about throwing a wild turkey. A front 1.5 flip into a half twist into as many back flips as one can execute before the bungee pulls taut. Dasher learned how to add the twist to the front flips by jumping off diving boards into swimming pools. It's how the trick got its name. "The only time I was willing to try it," says Dasher, "was after two shots of wild turkey." That night at Angel's Camp, Dasher aced it, didn't get tangled in the ropes, got off 3.5 backflips, just perfect. Afterward, McConkie sidled over and asked how he'd done it. Dasher didn't take him seriously. "I was like, yeah, right, this hippie is gonna pull off a wild turkey. I gave him like 2 lines of explanation, mostly rope management stuff, and walked away." Turns out, the damn hippie had mad skills. McConkie climbed up on the roof of the RV, bounced off the diving board, and nailed the trick on his first try. "Afterward," says Dasher, "it was on." It was on, all right. McConkie moved into the Primal House and tacked a $2 bill to his wall. That was always the bet. "We spent all our time trying to think up new bungee tricks," said Dasher. "Stuff no one had ever done before. It was always about pushing the envelope and pushing our creativity, and I bet you that $2 bill that I can do that." One of the things Dasher and McConkie learned to do was skydive. Another Primal House denizen, Frank the Gambler Gambale, taught them. A security systems designer by trade, Gambale started bungee jumping to let off steam. Pretty soon, he had a second job with Primal Instinct. One day, as he was setting up a bridge jump, a couple of guys wearing parachutes showed up, walked over to the railing, and hopped off. It was the first time Gambale had ever seen base jumping. It wouldn't be the last. While most skydivers put in a minimum of 200 airplane leaps before attempting a base jump, the gambler gave it a go after 12. He never looked back. Gambale went on to set a number of base records, including the longest free fall, 26 seconds, off the Troll Wall in Norway, and also found ways to put his security training to good use. For insurance reasons, jumping off buildings is frowned upon, so he would dress as a technician to sneak past security, then use his knowledge of locks and alarms to get to the launch site. These tactics helped him become the first to leap off New York's Chrysler Building, wherein, after hiding in the building all night, Gambale got off a 5 a.m. launch, silently floated to the ground, then cemented his legend by hailing a cab to flee the scene. In 1998, the gambler began teaching both McConkie and Dasher to base jump. By 1999, the lessons were over. In June of that year, Gambale leapt off of Yosemite's El Cap, landed safely in the meadow below, and was immediately greeted by two rangers. Base jumping is against the law in all national parks, and Yosemite's rangers are particularly zealous. Fearing arrest and a $5,000 fine, Gambale fled toward the Merced River, dumped his chute on the bank, then dove in. The cold water sapped his strength. The current did the rest. Divers didn't recover his body for 28 days. Both Dasher and McConkie took his passing hard, but action and adventure athletes have a different relationship with death. "When Frank died," recounts Dasher, "everybody told us it was time to stop base jumping. But that's not what Frank would have wanted. He believed in doing what you love, and we weren't going back. After he died, I quit my job and moved to the drop zone, a Tahoe area skydiving operation. I lived in a tent and packed chutes. Shane and I spent all our time trying to piece together Frank's knowledge. I would tell him something Frank had taught me, and he would tell me something Frank had taught him. And pretty soon, another $2 bet was born." In Gambale's honor, Dasher and McConkie created the Plunge to Your Death Camp. Future Red Bull Air Force member J.T. Holmes was one of the first to attend, along the way becoming one of the few to learn to base jump before learning to skydive. Afterward, Holmes was just as committed to his new sport as McConkie and Dasher, and this led to even more $2 bets. There was skyacking, which is skydiving in a kayak into a river. There was a bicycle jump, when Dasher rode a mountain bike out of an airplane. Ski base emerged from this period as well, then wingsuit ski base. "That was a big deal," Holmes says. "Wingsuit ski base jumping didn't come from a Bond film. It came from our imagination. No one had done it before. So when Shane had to try it out for the first time, yeah, we were all pretty nervous." Then Holmes invented a new way to attach a parachute to another parachute, which meant they could deploy one chute, cut it away, and deploy the next. "We had this idea about a double ski base," says Dasher, "where you would jump off a cliff and deploy your chute, then land on a hanging snowfield, cut away that chute, rip these amazing turns in a place no one had ever been before, leap off a giant cliff at the end, deploy that second parachute, and land somewhere far below." In March 2009, the double ski base was pitched to Red Bull, who sponsor all three athletes. Dasher was elsewhere, but Holmes and McConkie got backing to fly to Italy's Dolomites Range and make the attempt. It was by far the farthest anyone had ever taken either of these sports. It was so far beyond imagination that even today most people still can't wrap their heads around the idea. But that's probably because they're looking in the wrong direction. Jimmy Chin explains, "When people think about action and adventure sport athletes, the first thing, often the only thing, they think about is the physical risk involved. But I've gotten to know and work with an extremely diverse group of these athletes, from new school free skiers through grizzled 8,000-meter peak mountaineering veterans. And I've come to one conclusion about everyone, myself included. the greatest athletes aren't interested in the greatest risks. I mean, sometimes they're taken, sometimes not. But those physical risks are a byproduct of a much deeper desire to take creative risks. Don't be fooled by the danger. In action and adventure sports, creativity is always the point. Creative triggers. Why is creativity the point? Turns out, this is one of the trickier questions we have to answer. Obviously, the reason has plenty to do with flow, but the relationship between flow and creativity is complicated and not completely understood. Moreover, every time someone makes a list of skills needed in the 21st century, creativity tops it. The quality most desirable in a CEO? According to a global survey conducted by IBM of 1,500 top executives in 60 countries, creativity. What about the skills our children need to thrive in the future? According to the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, a collection of 250 researchers at 60 institutions, creativity is again the answer. So if ever there was a critical yet overused term in need of clarification, this is it. Let's start with a standard working definition of creativity. There are plenty to choose from, but the process of developing original ideas that have value is arguably the most common. So we'll go with that. The first thing to know about coming up with original, valuable ideas is how deeply this process scares us. Every time we have a creative insight and share it with the world, we come up against some very primal terrors. Fear of failure, fear of the unknown, fear of social ridicule, fear of loss of resources, time, money, access, etc. There's significant risk involved in every step of this process. Drilling down deeper, beyond the risk-taking involved in idea generation, there's a second mechanism at work. Pattern recognition. When Apple co-founder Steve Jobs said, "Creativity is just connecting things," he wasn't wrong. When coming up with a new idea, we always have to find patterns. That is, Jobs's connection between things that we haven't seen before. At a fundamental level, then, coming up with original, valuable ideas always requires risk-taking and pattern recognition. And this means dopamine. Dopamine is the pleasure chemical released whenever we take a risk or identify a pattern. We feel this inrush as excitement, engagement, and curiosity. But dopamine does more than just stimulate our emotions and increase our motivation. It also tightens focus, drives us into the now, and, thus, speeds entrance into flow. What all of this means is that the creative act, one that requires risk-taking and pattern recognition, is itself an exceptionally potent flow trigger. When you're concentrating on something that matters, explains Harvard psychologist Ned Hollowell, when you can't proceed on automatic pilot, that's when flow shows up. That's creativity to a T. Once you've thrown out the rule book and begun making creative decisions, the risk involved tightens focus and triggers a neurobiological cascade. It sweeps you right into flow. Even better, the flow state itself acts like a force multiplier for creativity. In flow, beyond this neurochemical reaction, there are also neuroanatomical and neuroelectrical changes taking place. Neuroanatomically, with large swatches of the prefrontal cortex deactivated, our inner critic is shut off and our inner monologue rendered silent. As a result, we're more receptive to novel experiences, the building blocks of new ideas, and much less inhibited, thus more likely to present those new ideas to the world. This is why, for example, in studies run by University of Pennsylvania psychologist Sharon Thompson Schill, when transient hypofrontality was artificially induced and subjects were presented with creative problems to solve, the hypofrontal subjects came up with more novel insights in far shorter time frames than control subjects. Neuroelectrically, Flo's baseline brainwave pattern of low alpha, high theta also boosts creativity. Alpha means we're calm, confident, and content, thus more willing to take risks. And that the lines of communication between the subconscious mind and the conscious mind are wide open, thus more chances for pattern recognition and novel insight. Theta, meanwhile, is a relaxed state where the brain can move from notion to notion without much internal resistance, like what happens when you're about to fall asleep, and has long been associated with intuition and idea generation. If we put this all together, what we find is a powerful reciprocity. Creativity triggers flow, then flow enhances creativity. But equally important to our story is how action and adventure athletes have taken advantage of this reciprocity. Part of this is simply the nature of these sports. When you're out skiing or skating with your friends, explains Micah Abrams, if you see your friend do something mind-bending, there's a natural inclination to immediately want to try it, to immediately want to add to it. Everyone builds off each other. It's competition and creativity and rolled into one. Or, as Miles Dasher explained, it was always about pushing the envelope and pushing our creativity, and I bet you that $2 bill that I can do that. Of course, creative one-upsmanship has been a part of action and adventure sports for a very long time. What changed, the key factor that allowed these athletes to take such complete advantage of this flow trigger, and, arguably, the fundamental alteration that lit the fuse on the accelerated progression at the heart of this audiobook, was the turbo boost known as the free ride movement. The movement dates back to the 1980s, when snowboarding was still a banned sport at most resorts. The original free riders were snowboarders who got around this ban by taking their show into the backcountry, where they were free from resort rules and free to interpret that terrain any way they wanted. This freedom, of course, translated into far greater opportunities for creativity, which triggered more flow, which further enhanced creativity, which supercharged the rate of innovation, jacked up performance, and, when captured on celluloid, looked like such ridiculous fun that everyone wanted in on the action. Shane McConkie included. In the 1990s, McConkie borrowed the term free to apply to skiing. He also extended its meaning. Shane desperately wanted to get away from the popularized word extreme, says Scott Gaffney. It was overused and did not define the kind of skiing he felt he enjoyed most. So he coined the term free skiing. That's where it originated. Now the free prefix is used in all kinds of action sports. For example, free surfing and free riding, meaning on a mountain bike, when people are performing outside of competition. More important, free riding tilted the value structure of action and adventure sports. It overemphasized self-expression. It de-emphasized winning. And especially de-emphasized the idea of a solitary winner. As long as free riders were seeing interesting lines and riding those lines in interesting ways, they were winning. No longer was the fastest person down the mountain the best athlete on the mountain. To really win, you had to be creative. Creativity became the way athletes judged success, continues Jimmy Chin. Did I pick a cool line? Did it look stylish? Was I innovative? Did I add anything to the conversation? It's why so many of these guys now see themselves as artists as much as athletes. Free riding changed the culture. And because all of these creative free riding choices triggered flow, this cultural change was reinforced. Over and again. What began as an individual value became a societal virtue. These days, imagination and innovation form the basis for how these athletes are judged and judge themselves. It's also how they get paid. You don't just need to be better, stronger, faster to get a part in an action and adventure sports movie. You need to be all those things and still show us something new. Most important, You need fierce commitment to vision. You need to be willing to bet your ass on your idea. Think about this for a moment. While all creative types take risks for their ideas, very few are willing to go as far as action and adventure athletes. When Dasher dreamed up skyacking, if that little insight had been a bad one? Or when Holmes invented the technology that opened the door for the double ski base? Or when McConkie tried out wingsuit ski base for the first time? All of these acts required a level of commitment to creativity not often seen in society. By way of comparison, consider entrepreneurship. Starting a company is considered one of the riskiest and most creative acts in business. We celebrate the risk-taking of entrepreneurs. We lionize their unwavering commitment to innovation. Well, Danny Way's Mega Ramp was an innovation that cost more than $500,000 to build, or roughly what it takes to get a startup off the ground. And Way didn't just have to raise that cash, that is, convince his sponsors to pony up. He also had to be the first guy down the results. Or the Strapped Crew with their invention of tow surfing. How many organizations do their product research at Jaws, at Chopu, at Mavericks? Because this is the other half of the creativity story. It's not merely that action and adventure athletes take advantage of this flow trigger. It's that they have made creativity so core to the culture that the culture is willing to die for their creativity. You want more proof? A few days before McConkie and Holmes left for Italy to attempt the double ski base for the first time, McConkie was hanging with Dasher back in California. "He was giving me a lecture," says Dasher. "He was saying, 'What we do for a living? We both have families. You need to tighten up your ends. You have to have a will.'" The Fall of Superman. Shane McConkie and J.T. Holmes arrived in Italy for their shot at the double ski base on March 25th, 2009. After a few days scouting locations, a day spent nailing a ski base, single, not double, off the 8,612-foot Sosnger, and a couple more lost to bad weather, they took the cable car to the top of the Sas Pordoi, a 9,685-foot mountain in the Dolomites. The view from the top is one of the best in the range. There's a restaurant up there and a nice lookout spot. McConkie and Holmes had a cup of coffee at the former, then spent some time at the latter, hunting a suitable location for the double ski base. They found one, too, just perfect, but decided to save that fun for another day. Instead, the Sas Pordoi also features a gorgeous 2,000-foot cliff that McConkie had ski-based the previous summer. That day, if the damn wind would ever die down, he wanted to give wingsuit ski-base a try. The damn wind finally died down. McConkie and Holmes hiked out to the cliff and roped down to a spot below the edge. From there, McConkie threw rocks and started counting. He counted 10, maybe 12 seconds before impact. Plenty of time, he figured, for everything that needed to be done on the way down. Still, the launch would be critical. McConkie and Holmes built a big jump at the cliff's edge, but the snow was crappy, so they started over. The second time was the charm. With the kicker dialed, they climbed into their flight gear and snapped into their skis. Holmes went first. He pointed his boards toward the cliff, made a few quick turns, then nailed a perfect double backflip into the abyss. McConkie was left alone on the side of the mountain. He had a GoPro camera on his head and was wired for sound. "Oh yeah," he said into the microphone. "Here we go! Another wingsuit ski base!" Then he exhaled deeply, just once, and pointed his tips toward the edge. It was a fantastic takeoff. He hit the jump perfectly, sailed off the Sas Pordoi, and did what he could not back in Crested Butte so many years before. A perfect double backflip. It was the last time something in his life went right. It's impossible to steer a wingsuit with skis on, so McConkie had invented a release system, really just a strap to yank on that unlatched his bindings. But when he yanked, only his right ski popped off. It then got tangled with his left. He reached down to manually release the binding, but the move flipped him upside down, which meant he could neither see the ground approaching nor deploy his parachute for fear of further entanglement. Some people, including Dasher, believe you should throw the chute anyway. But McConkie had long argued for the need to release the skis first, get into a stable position for flight, and then throw the chute. He did, in fact, manage to release his ski and get into a stable position. "It was an amazing recovery," Holmes said afterward. "But he was already too late." McConkie died on impact. He left behind a wife, a 3-year-old daughter, and a 15-year legacy that, despite the startling rate of progression in these sports, will most likely remain unmatched for some time. As former Powder magazine managing editor Leslie Anthony wrote in White Planet, "The ski world Superman was gone." The double ski base remains, though, the chapter yet unwritten. Holmes says it's only a matter of time, and if he doesn't do it, someone else will. That's the tradition. That's how these things get done. That's really why McConkie was considered a genius. He did what all geniuses do. He shifted the paradigm. He opened our eyes. He gave his life so that, maybe, we could reinvent ours. Part 3. Time to Rise. "We are the ones that we've been waiting for." Alice Walker. 10. The Dark Side of Flow. Jeremy Jones. As a rule, most mountain men are, well, mountains. Big guys, head to toe. They tend toward thickness, with the extra weight needed to not shake apart when the temperatures drop below zero. They tend toward tallness, as winter mountaineering demands trailblazing through deep snow, and those of lesser stature end up swallowed while post-holing. They are not, as a rule, 5'7" and 145 pounds. Then again, when has Jeremy Jones, 10 times voted snowboard Big Mountain Rider of the Year, ever followed the rules? As a child in Vermont, back when snowboarding was still banned at most resorts, he spent the majority of his time alone, dragging his board up backyard hills, riding down, and repeating. He barged onto the circuit back before it was a circuit. A story his O'Neill, one of Jones' sponsors, biography, sums up nicely. "Without the sponsors and support today's athletes may take for granted, Jones started competing at 14, and though averaging about 35 contests a season, he didn't stay in a hotel until he was 20. One winter he ate more than 300 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and graduated high school $10,000 in debt. He'd lose 15 pounds each winter, and one season got so sick he gave his sponsors an ultimatum. Either they upped their support or he'd have to walk away. He saw all of it, though, as an initiation. You have to earn your deal, he reasons. The better the job, the harder the initiation." Yet, despite the grueling nature of his initiation, Jones walked away from the job. On his way to his very first pro competition, he stopped to visit his brothers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and took a sharp left turn. Instead of becoming a world champion racer, Jones decided he'd rather wash dishes for the chance to free ride Jackson every day. Jackson Hole is not your average ski mountain. The inbounds terrain is the most ferocious in the lower 48. The out-of-bounds terrain, harsher still. Point of fact, the first 3 extreme ski contests held in Alaska were all won by Jackson Hole skiers. It was also Jackson Hole skiers and snowboarders who pioneered Alaska as the mecca of winter sports filmmaking. In fact, it was Jeremy's brothers, Todd and Steve Jones, alongside Dirk Collins and Corey Gavitt, who co-founded the extreme sports filmmaking company Teton Gravity Research, TGR, and did much of that pioneering. Along similar lines, while Jackson introduced Jeremy to the possibilities of big mountain riding, It was Alaska that sealed the deal. In 1998, the first year TGR was making films in the far north, Jeremy flew up for a visit. Alaska was a different planet, he recalls. On that first trip, I was as scared as I've ever been, riding the biggest lines of my life, making the fastest turns of my life, and afterward I'd realize I hadn't come close to hitting my limits, that I could have gone even bigger, even faster. The rules were different up there. It's like we'd found a place that had the best snow, totally unexplored, and, by the way, there's less gravity, too. Over the next decade, Jeremy became part of a group of snowboarders, skiers, and filmmakers who established Alaska as snow sport's ultimate proving ground. It was brain-scrambling, he says. Things that were impossible in the morning were possible by the evening. Literally. Rules that were adhered to vehemently, rules that had been in place since the beginning of winter sports, rules like, don't do this because you'll die, were changing on a daily, sometimes hourly basis. It was also the beginning of the end. Different people have different gateways into flow. Jeremy favors a rich environment. Novelty, complexity, and unpredictability are his favorite triggers. Unfortunately, in Alaska, choppers are only allowed to fly in certain permitted areas. Within a few years, all of Valdez had been explored. Then the athletes and filmmakers moved to Haines and opened up another frontier. Within a few more years, every inch of Haines had also been explored. It was a serious problem for Jeremy. I would find myself at the top of these amazing lines, he says, except I had ridden them 5 times before. In that kind of familiar territory, to get the buzz I wanted, I was having to redline 60-degree chutes, over big cliffs, chasing avalanches, really, really out there. And that was all I was doing, flying to the top of mountains, pushing farther out onto that edge. I just knew it was only a matter of time before something went really, really wrong. Jones also knew that the bureaucratic boundary only applied to helicopters. If he was willing to hike for his turns, he could go as uncharted as desired. But uncharted meant self-sufficiency. It meant fortitude. And with storms that can last for weeks, it also meant that rescue and resupply were non-existent possibilities. Plus, his new plan involved climbing up the peaks he wanted to snowboard down, an idea that would compound the already significant dangers of big mountain snowboarding with the long list of catastrophes that come with high alpine mountaineering. There's an upside and a downside, explains Jeremy. The downside is that to make the climb, I have to spend 3 hours like a sitting duck. Avalanches, of course. But one tiny snowball that knocks free at the top of a couloir can become the size of a refrigerator by the time it reaches the bottom. I need all of my senses peaking to survive. And that's the upside. Climbing drives me right into the zone. This makes a big difference on the way down. I notice everything. The blind rollover suddenly isn't blind. Snow stability and where the fractures are, and unlike helicopter riding, when you get to the top and have only a few seconds to get into the zone before dropping in, I know I'll be in there on my descent. If I climb to the top successfully, that's 95% of what I'm worried about. When I take off down my line, I know I'm already peaking, which means I can push my limits that much further. Jones envisioned what came to be called the deeper experiment, being dropped off by a plane far outside the helicopter permit zone. He wanted to spend a month in remote Alaska, just a small crew living out of tents, climbing for all of their turns. It would not be easy. He knew he would need a postgraduate level education in snow science, meteorology, and mountaineering to prepare. He'd have to convince his sponsors, who were then making bank on helicopter scenes in Alaska, that the much slower process of snowboard mountaineering would entice their audiences. And he needed a team, athletes, filmmakers, guides, etc., willing to roll some damn uncertain dice. It took 4 years to put the expedition together. By the early spring of 2009, he was finally ready. TGR had agreed to make his trip into a movie. His sponsors had agreed to foot the bill, and athletes like Travis Rice and Jonovan Moore had agreed to roll those dice. The plan was to fly to Haines, then head into Glacier Bay National Park. They would use a small plane to hunt a high cirque rising from a flat plain, where they could set up camp far outside avalanche range, pack 2 weeks' worth of supplies, and get dropped off. 2 weeks later, the plane would fly back and make a second supply drop. In the interim, they would take expedition snowboarding farther than ever before. Big surprise. Little went according to plan. Jeremy had lived in Jackson Hole for a few years, but later migrated to the Tahoe area. Shane McConkie had become one of his best friends. Their wives were close. Their children played together. One day after arriving in Alaska, 4 years after he began planning the deeper trip, Jeremy's phone rang. Shane had died in Italy.
I flew home. Shane's wife and daughters moved in with me and my wife for a couple of weeks. But I couldn't stay. All these people were depending on me. 4 days later, I had to fly back to Alaska and start the trip.
Jones returned to Alaska just as the weather cleared. They used that window to location scout, eventually finding a suitable base camp some 60 miles outside of Haines. They had 2 days to set up that camp before Jeremy flew back to Tahoe for Shane's funeral. A day after that, he was back in Alaska.
It was heavy, he says. Deeper had been my dream for years. But after the funeral, at 4:30 in the morning, when I'm driving to the airport, the very last thing I wanted to do was head back into the mountains.
Heavier was the weather that followed Jones back to camp. A 10-day storm blew in, bringing temperatures of 20 below. Jones, stuck in a tent, had plenty of time to think about everything that had just happened. It raised the proverbial question, why do we do this? But I got to see up close the incredibly powerful effect Shane had on people. Most people are so afraid of dying they never live. Shane lived his life to the fullest. He lived thousands of lifetimes and changed thousands of lives. The world needs more people like Shane. And that was exactly why I was on this expedition, to push into uncharted territory, to try to experience life to the fullest, to bring a little of that back to the rest of the world. On the 11th day, just as they were about to run out of food, the storm cleared. Blue skies and big mountains. Before the storm, Travis Rice had started building a massive jump over a huge crevasse gap. As soon as the sun returned, he finished the project and kicked off the show. 60 miles from nowhere, no rescue available, Rice threw an 80-foot cork backside 720 over the gap. From that moment on, no one looked back. They stayed in the backcountry a month in total, along the way pushing snowboard mountaineering farther than anyone had taken it before. Throughout the whole expedition, Jeremy carried a portion of Shane's ashes. He also named a peak after him.
It's a really ascetic line, says Jeremy. I knew that once people saw it, they would want to come ride it, and they would get that same feeling that I got, that Shane got. And when they left, they would bring a little bit of that back to the world.
The pitfalls and the path. In parts 1 and 2 of this audiobook, we've examined the state of flow and the cutting edge of flow hacking. We've built a bridge between the extreme and the mainstream, seeing what action and adventure athletes are doing to reliably reproduce this state and how to start applying this information in our own lives. But this merely marks the beginning of a much longer trek. Thus, part 3 of this audiobook is devoted to seeing where this trail goes. It's a look at our future in flow. For starters, our focus here is the immediate future. Our immediate future. Once you begin applying the techniques described in this book, you'll immediately start producing more flow in your life, which also means you need to be prepared for the ramifications.
Flow is an alternative path toward mastery, but, like any path, not without its pitfalls. There's a serious dark side to flow, and this chapter provides a map to that minefield. The state of flow, like the path that bears its name, is volatile, unpredictable, and all-consuming. Flow feels like the meaning of life for good reason. The neurochemicals that underpin the state are among the most addictive drugs on earth. Equally powerful is the psychological draw. Scientists who study human motivation have lately learned that after basic survival needs have been met, the combination of autonomy, the desire to direct your own life, mastery, the desire to learn, explore, and be creative, and purpose, the desire to matter, to contribute to the world, are our most powerful intrinsic drivers, the three things that motivate us most. All three are deeply woven through the fabric of flow. Thus, toying with flow involves tinkering with primal biology, addictive neurochemistry, potent psychology, and hardwired evolutionary behaviors. Seriously, what could go wrong? And that's part of the problem. Even when everything goes right, things go wrong. Walking this path demands constantly increasing the challenges we face. We are climbing a ladder of escalating risk, with this ladder being the first of the dangers encountered on the flow path. Continuously pushing on the challenge-skill ratio means it's scary here, and it's going to get scarier. Sooner or later, if we stay on this path long enough, pushing past one's comfort zone is going to require exceeding traditional margins for safety. As a working artist, this could mean moving beyond popular tastes. See first bebop, later free jazz musicians, early impressionist painters, auteur filmmakers, etc. And risking, in many cases, one's livelihood. For action and adventure athletes, of course, the consequences can be much more severe. Take Jeremy Jones's trajectory. He chased flow from a racing career into big mountain riding into the helicopter whirl of Alaska, upping the danger level with every step. And when helicopters proved insufficient, he decided to add mountaineering into the mix. If measuring simply by the size of the body count, on the list of ways to get dead in the extreme, mountaineering wins no contest. Seriously. If he keeps it up, what are the chances Jeremy Jones dies of natural causes? And while there's clearly an order of magnitude difference between them, beyond the physical risks, Jones's relentless commitment to the path jeopardized his financial future as well. When he first took up snowboarding, it was barely a sport, let alone one with a future. He devoted his teenage years to sleeping in cars and hoping an actual industry would emerge. And once it did emerge, he walked away. At the time Jones switched from competitive riding to big mountain riding, the rest of the snowboard world was solely interested in half pipes and flippy tricks, neither of which were then part of the big mountain landscape. And when Jones decided to start snowboard mountaineering, hella riding was where all the sponsorship dollars were lodged. At each of these steps, and plenty of others in between, Jones chanced his career. And these types of decisions are not too unusual on this path. All or nothing tends to be the kind of commitment flow demands, and it demands it of everyone. If you embark down this road, the requisite risk-taking will continuously back you into uncomfortable corners. It's almost ironic. How many self-help books have been written about living with passion and purpose, that is, traveling the flow path? Yet how few actually mention the dangers involved. Equally insidious is how flow prepares us to handle these dangers. In the state, our skills are peaking, our inner critic shut down, and our ability to feel fear significantly dampened. "I felt I could not be hurt," wrote Brazilian soccer star Pelé in his autobiography, My Life and the Beautiful Game. "Perhaps it was merely confidence, but I have felt confident many times before without that strange feeling of invincibility." And while Pelé's correct, there's a serious catch. Flow makes you feel invincible right up to the moment you're not. After all, Shane McConkie was the closest thing to Superman the world has yet seen, and he didn't beat those odds. Nor is he alone. "The joy I get from skiing, that's worth dying for," said C.R. Johnson, not long before he died skiing. Canadian freestyle skier and four-time X Games champ Sarah Burke is now sorely missed. So are Arnie Backstrom, Caleb Moore, Jeremy Lusk, Ryan Hawks, Aaron Robinson, Kip Gar, Antoine Montan, and many more. ESPN called 2011 the grimmest year in action sports collective history, and then explained why. The action sports community averaged one pro athlete death every 3 weeks. The year 2013, while not yet in the books, is starting to look grimmer than 2011. Does this mean we have to be willing to face mortality to chase flow? Not exactly. Flow forces you to evaluate life through a different lens. It gives you reason to live, but live this way long enough, and those reasons become more important than dying. This is what the self-help books don't tell you. Fully alive and deeply committed is a risky business. Once you strip away the platitudes, a life of passion and purpose will always cost, as T.S. Eliot reminds us, not less than everything. The dark side, the bliss junkies, and the question of control. Almost everything we've just covered, however dangerous, falls under the category of that which can go wrong when almost everything goes right. This is what happens when we begin finding flow with regularity. But the state is unpredictable, and there are no guarantees. A great many discover flow accidentally, having no idea how they got there or how to return. Still others, even those who once had easy access to the zone, may suddenly find themselves cut off from the source, trapped in a struggle phase without end. In either case, once flow becomes a lock without a key, the ramifications are soul-sucking, to say the least. "No question about it," says Flow Genome Project Executive Director Jamie Wheel. "There's a dark night of the flow." In Christian mystical traditions, once you've experienced the grace of God, the dark night of the soul describes the incredible pain of its absence. The same is true for flow. An enormous gap sits between the ecstasy of the zone and the all-too-familiar daily toil waiting for us on the other end. If you've glimpsed this state but can't get back there, that lack can become unbearable. Even those familiar with flow can go through long stretches where the state becomes inaccessible. The struggle can last weeks, months, occasionally years. As climber Dean Potter explains, these periods are true trial by fire. "When I feel that really draining side of not being able to enter into the flow, it's horrible. I feel helpless, lethargic, restless, disturbed. The positive here is I hate that feeling so much it makes me more focused. I take all the necessary steps to get out of it as soon as I can. Sometimes, though, I end up sunk in a really bad place. True depression, trapped for quite some time. But even here there's an upside. At those times, doing anything hurts so much, I can only do what truly inspires me. Otherwise, I have no power. This allows me to lock onto ideas that are authentically mine. So the dark side of flow, for all its torment, keeps me being exactly who I am." Potter, at least, has the ability to find his way to the other side. What about the college lacrosse star who graduates into a job as an accountant, much needed to feed her family, but not a territory nearly as rich in flow triggers as competitive high-contact sports? The one-time drummer now working as a stockbroker? The mother of three who used to do some sculpture when she was younger but now has no time for herself? As professional big-wave surfer-turned-filmmaker Cattle rancher and Patagonia Ocean Ambassador Chris Malloy pointed out in an email to me, sometimes being cut off from the source simply means growing older. I hope you talk a little about how utterly fucked we can become when we get too old or broken or smart to keep it up. Not all of us experience a happy life after doing this shit for a couple of decades. I bet there are some PTSD similarities. It's funny. I read Sebastian Younger's War, and I learned something. The guys coming home are all screwed up, not because they saw people die as much as they missed the rush. I would never put myself in the same category as those fighting men, but it can be hard to get excited again. Ever. And that feeling sucks. And the dark night of flow is an issue that society has not made particularly easy to handle. How many people have stopped playing guitar, writing poetry, or painting watercolors, activities packed with flow triggers, because these are also activities that do not squarely fit into culturally acceptable responsibility categories like career or children? How many, now grown up and done with childish things, have put away the surfboard, the skateboard, the whatever? How many have made the mistake of conflating the value of the vehicle that leads us to an experience, the surfboard, etc., with the value of the experience itself, the flow state? What's painfully ironic here is that flow is a radical and alternative path to mastery only because we have decided that play, an activity fundamental to survival, tied to the greatest neurochemical rewards the brain can produce, and flat-out necessary for achieving peak performance, creative brilliance, and overall life satisfaction, is a waste of time for adults. If we are hunting the highest version of ourselves, then we need to turn work into play, and not the other way round. Unless we invert this equation, much of our capacity for intrinsic motivation starts to shut down. We lose touch with our passion and become less than what we could be, and that feeling never really goes away. The dark night of the flow happens when people glimpse the state and can't get back there. But another issue arises when people are getting into flow, yet misinterpreting its meaning. The automatic nature of the state, how every decision, every action, leads seamlessly to the next, lays a different kind of trap. It can turn flow junkies into bliss junkies. Bliss junkies are people who think the magical ease of the flow state is the goal, says Wheel. When they confront the difficulty of the day-to-day, they'd rather reach for a pill or a new lover or another meditation retreat than get down to hard work. The idea being, if it was all so easy, clear, and effortless in flow, then why not wait for the next wave to hit? Not being in flow becomes an excuse to stay listless and undermotivated. We don't have to look far for examples. Think of rave culture or the New Age movement, or just about any holdover hippie community, or, for that matter, almost every ski or surf town in the world. And when listless and undermotivated, bliss junkies often turn to drugs, alcohol, gambling, sex, and other high-risk behaviors to mask the pain of flow's loss, or to hasten its return. And these issues are only part of this picture. In this accounting of flow's dark side, the categories we've so far examined, the escalating ladder of risk, the dark night of the flow, and the meaning miscalculations of the bliss junkie, are all personal and psychological. But there are also cultural issues to consider, namely, the question of whether flow can be corrupted or controlled. Neither question is easy to answer. Corruption is problematic because flow increases empathy and social bonding. But that doesn't mean pickup artists or pickpockets can't co-opt the state to further their craft. Along similar lines, no one knows if flow can be used to train super soldiers, but the U.S. Defense Department seems committed to finding out. Most of the high-performance scientists in this book work with both athletes and the military. Red Bull, for example, has teamed up with the Navy SEALs. DARPA funds flow research, the aforementioned sniper study. Whether this is a good thing or a bad thing depends on one's trust in government and feelings for nation-states. But it doesn't take much to imagine how this experiment could go wrong. On a slightly different scale, society likes to pay for performance, and flow definitely improves performance. In action and adventure sports, for example, flow's escalating ladder of risk, once cause for marginalization, now supports an entire industry. And these supporters want footage. Thus, athletes on a heli-ski film shoot, who use their ability to get into flow to get that job, can't back away from a run just because they're not feeling the flow. Not if they want to continue to have a career. These economic pressures are pushing people past their challenge, skill, sweet spot, and with the expected results. Squaw Valley psychiatrist Dr. Rob Gaffney, Scott's brother, who McConkie once called the best non-pro skier in the world, recently told NBC Sports, "All my friends who have been lost were the best at what they did, worldwide. And yet we still lost them. I do see corporate sponsorship as a big player here. They're making a lot of money. They've tapped into a reward center in the brain. The thrill seekers are going for it. The culture's enthralled with it. It's a money-making machine." Now, certainly, not all of us face such dire consequences in our chosen professions, but this doesn't solve the problem. Even in less extreme work lives, once we start accessing flow with regularity, performance will dramatically improve and new expectations will follow. Those added expectations will push the difficulty level up a few notches, and this extra psychological burden can easily send us past the challenge skill sweet spot, rendering us unable to access the very state we need to meet those new expectations. The second issue here is whether flow can be controlled. Doubtful. In technological terms, a disruptive technology is any innovation that creates a new market and new values, and eventually displaces an old market and older values. Cars replacing horse-drawn carriages is the classic example. Flow is also a very disruptive technology. Unlike the automobile, it's not a disruptive external technology, but a disruptive internal technology, operating in the psychological rather than the physical world. This does not make it any less potent. The athletes in this audiobook harness the state to displace traditional markets. Today, top jocks are just as likely to skateboard as play football. Alter our value system. Our societal tolerance for and reward of high-risk behavior has seriously increased. And reshape culture, a $750 billion lifestyle industry. Thus the rub. Flow, like all technologies, remains morally neutral. It can be used for good or ill or both at the same time. In esoteric terms, flow's tendency toward disruption is the reason it could be considered a left-hand path. A right-hand path is a path of orthodoxy. It's cut, dry, and filled with thou shalt nots. On a right-hand path, we follow the rules and do what we're told, and no questions asked. This may sound dull, but right-hand paths have a very long history of keeping us safe. A left-hand path, meanwhile, is an ecstatic path, and mostly gray. It's little guidance and less security. Lao Tzu, founder of Taoism, warned that a left-hand path is best never begun, and once begun, must absolutely be finished. But how to finish such a path? We have a vast gap in our knowledge. Our society has spent centuries waging war against torment. When we are depressed, we know how to fight for happiness. When we are ill, we have guidebooks toward health. When we are loveless, jobless, hopeless, not smart enough, not skilled enough, not good enough, we now have colossal industries and institutions designed to teach us to strive and seek. We have become really good at negotiating with darkness, for certain. But how much do we really know about the light? How much do we really know about true happiness? burning creativity, unbridled ecstasy. As children, we are taught not to play with fire, not how to play with fire.